Hi, I'm Clarice Larson, and you're listening to KTOO. An affordable housing project built specifically for people in recovery from substance misuse received funding support from the Juneau Assembly this week. On Monday, the Assembly unanimously approved a grant for $2 million to the Gatineau Human Services, a local nonprofit that works to help people affected by homelessness or addiction. The funding will help the nonprofit construct a three-story building with 51 long-term housing units in the Lemon Creek area.
This is a long-term, cost-effective way to work with the root causes of homelessness and providing a home and the support so that people can work their way out of the terrible conditions.
That's Dave Ringel, the executive director of Juneau's St. Vincent de Paul chapter. At the meeting, he was one of the multiple people who testified in support of the grant. He says the project is critical to getting people out of homelessness and into stable situations. Usually, affordable housing projects like this one have to apply for money through the city's Affordable Housing Fund, competing against other projects for funding. But the nonprofit was facing a tight deadline to submit its applications for other grants, and the Assembly agreed to fund it anyways. The nonprofit will still need to puzzle together another $9.5 million from other sources. Lauren Connolly is a nurse at the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium's Front Street Clinic. It's geared toward assisting homeless and low-income patients in Juneau. During testimony, she says there's an urgent need for housing units like this in Juneau.
In my job, even before I knew anything about this project, you could definitely recognize the need for more supportive, sober living here in Juneau.
The nonprofit's goal is to have construction begin in 2025 with housing available in 2026. And now for Curious Juneau, KTOO's Anna Canny brings us this week's episode.
It's a misty afternoon, and I'm headed to meet KTOO listener Mark Wheeler in the parking lot of Foodland downtown.
You want to talk by the Ravens?
Yeah, let's see.
Over here.
Oh, nice. Okay. He leads me to a large group of Ravens that are perched on a chain link fence.
Yeah, I live pretty close by. So sometimes I'll go to Foodland, get something to eat, and I'll be like walking while I eat it. And they'll like literally like follow you like a gang of thugs, you know, because they're just counting on you dropping something.
Like many Junoites, Wheeler has had a lot of fun watching the curious corvids that wander around downtown. But he noticed that many of them disappear at sundown. So it got him wondering, where do they go at night?
Where's the roost?
For this installment of Curious Juneau, I did some late-night detective work to find out. My first lead came from Bob Armstrong, a naturalist and wildlife photographer who's been working in Juneau for more than 60 years. In that time, he's photographed hundreds of ravens. One of his favorite shots from Foodland shows a bird with a bright red cup of Raven's Brew coffee.
So I came into the parking lot and just put some latte in it and just set it about 20 feet away from the car, and just sat there and waited.
Within a few minutes, a half dozen birds started pecking at it. Eventually, one took the lid in its beak and lifted the cup to show off an illustration of a raven with its wings outstretched. That's when Armstrong snapped a picture.
But then what surprised me is it opened the lid of the cup, and then it drank the latte that was in there.
Ravens are scavengers, meaning they spend their days looking for something, anything, to eat. Insects, berries, eggs, trash from the landfill, and lattes. But their roosting habits are more mysterious. Despite his decades of observation, Armstrong couldn't tell me where ravens go at bedtime.
It requires some probably tagging and that sort of thing.
Scientists in Fairbanks once used radio transmitter tags to track urban ravens on a 40-mile commute to their roost outside the city. But KTOO doesn't have the budget for radio transmitters. At least, not that kind of radio transmitter. So I had to find a more low-tech method. Armstrong did have one idea. He said he thinks he's seen ravens roosting in a couple of trees on Willoughby Avenue.
Because if I go to Bullwinkle's for pizza at night and then walk along that sidewalk there, I hear a lot of ravens talking.
So I went there first, at dusk. I got hungry.
It smells like pizza.
But I didn't see any ravens. Then I remembered another thing Armstrong said. He's noticed a few ravens in parking garages nearby. So I charged into the echoey, dimly lit parking garage across the street. The first sign of ravens was actually something that people had installed to keep them out.
Can you hear that? There are sort of these, you know, those spikes that you see to keep birds off, keep birds from perching.
But then I spotted my next clue while looking up at the concrete railing of the third floor.
That is just smattered in white bird poop, almost the way it would look if a bunch of birds were perched up on the ledge with their butts facing out towards me.
Then a breakthrough nestled in a few U-shaped pipes.
Oh, there's a nest. There's a nest.
It was made of big sticks, and it looked to be about a foot across. I think it was empty, but I watched it for 20 minutes as it kept getting darker. No ravens appeared. Even though I'd seen plenty of signs that ravens do indeed hang out in the parking garage, I wasn't satisfied. I wanted to look inside the mind of the raven. For that, I turned to John Marsloff, a retired professor of wildlife science at the University of Washington. He spent his career studying crows, jays, and ravens.
There are kind of two strategies in a raven society.
The first one is for older breeding pairs. These birds mate for life, and mates tend to roost together. They're also fiercely territorial, especially when they're tending to a nest like the one I saw in the parking garage.
The rest of raven world are what we call vagrant non-breeders.
And these ravens are the most low-ranking in the bunch. They aren't tied to a particular spot that they're defending or returning to.
They may aggregate at rich food sources like foodland, but it's not the same birds every day. You know, to say that there's a flock or a group that's the foodland ravens, probably not the case.
So there's probably no such thing as the foodland ravens, just ravens that happen to be at foodland. And that makes sense because mostly they're following food. Marsloff's research has shown that ravens travel thousands of square miles looking for their next meal. They're flexible based on changing seasons or the surprise delicacies that might appear.
If all of a sudden there's a, you know, a big spill of a bag of dog food at foodland, that word's going to get out because the birds that are there will be very active and other birds will hear or see them and come in, and there's a lot of attraction to the commotion.
Marsloff says these vagrant non-breeders will often use roosting as a way to share information. They meet up and form larger communal roosts with dozens or even hundreds of ravens. And there, when they're settling in to get some sleep, they communicate about food sources or predator threats that they encountered during the day. These roosts are often found in tree stands or cliffs, but in an urban environment, that might change. A parking garage, for instance, is usually close to easy food.
It's also warm, and it's also sheltered from the elements, and maybe even a little bit lighter, so they can see any oncoming potential predator. And it might just be the perfect place.
So I tried that theory again, this time in the parking garage of the downtown library.
Okay, I was really about to give up, but I found them.
On the top level of the garage,
there's one, two, three, one on a light post here.
A bunch of ravens were perched in the eaves.
7, 8, 9, there's sort of a cluster of them in one corner.
13 in total. A superstitious number.
It's a little bit scary, actually. It's just past 10 p.m. at night, and I got a bunch of ravens staring me down. I'm kind of blowing up their spot.
They did not want to be interviewed. Makes sense. I basically broke into their house while they were sleeping. In Juneau, I'm Anna Canny.
A 91-year-old cruise tourist is suing the Ketchikan Borough for negligence after his mobility scooter tipped over on a public bus. The complaint was filed in federal court in Alaska Wednesday. It says that John Gillingham of Montana and his wife were on a cruise that docked in Ketchikan in September of last year. Gillingham has limited mobility, so they rented a motorized scooter and boarded a public bus. The complaint states that the elderly man's mobility scooter tipped over when the bus had made a left turn. It also says that Gillingham sustained serious injuries from the fall, though he wasn't aware of it at the time. It wasn't until he returned to the cruise ship and later evaluated at Bartlett Regional Hospital in Juneau that he found he allegedly sustained 3 broken ribs and a punctured lung. Ketchikan's public bus have straps along the side to secure mobility scooters. Gillingham's attorneys claim that because the straps aren't mandatory, the driver didn't use them. Gillingham's attorney, Mark Chiodi, declined to comment on the case in an email. Ketchikan Borough Manager Ruben Duran also stated in an email that he was aware of a potential lawsuit, but he hasn't been served any notice. In Juneau, I'm Clarice Larson. Thank you so much for listening.